Welcome to the Post-Christian Podcast. My name is Eric Bryant. I'm one of the executive pastors at Gateway in Austin, Texas. My foundation exists to equip and empower church leaders in reaching new people and raising up leaders. I'm the author of Not Like Me and Fruitful, Becoming Who God Created You to Be. Join me on social media for Through the New Testament for Skeptics and Seekers. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter where you can receive free resources at ericbryant.org. Today, I have the honor of the amazing one and only Rob Overholt joining on the podcast. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm doing well, Eric. Thank you so much for having me. I can't tell you how much it means to me.
Well, it's really fun. My first podcast was with you back in the day.
It was. We had
Start
a lot
Good
of fun
Things. We that. Did. Yeah. Start Good Things podcast. It was certainly a lot of fun. We go further back than that when you were a church planner. I was at Mosaic. Then we got to team together here in Austin, saw a lot of momentum in those years. And
I think we met in like 2006. So I want to say we're coming up on 20 years. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Yes. Spent the night at your house in the days when you lived in Vegas.
That's right.
Lots of years serving together. Shala on the team here at Gateway as well. And these last several years have been tough. And I am really grateful you took the time to write a book called Grief, Meditations on the Struggle to Embrace Life's Troubles. You've been living in a season that's been very difficult. And really, I think, point out something incredibly important. We don't know how to grieve in our culture. Maybe just kind of share a little bit since you moved away from Austin, even just before, why you even moved away from Austin. Maybe pick us up from where we left off on the Start Good Things podcast. What's happened since then that led to this book?
Yeah. Start Good Things was a lot of fun. It was a combination of depth and middle school, which is, was really good.
That's our style.
Yeah, that's right. And if those who don't know, I got a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis back in the first part of 2019. So it's been nearly 5 years. And that really made me disabled, made me have to stop working, cause deep, deep depression. As the disease causes depression, and then you're dealing with the loss of everything that you're experiencing as a result of having the disease. So a lot of depression, lots of things I've battled the last 5 years. And as I traumas from my past and from my youth were revisited. I'm told by neurologists and very smart people that deal with our limbic system in my therapy sessions that when you have trauma in your past and you have a new trauma, even later in life, your brain doesn't see the original trauma as a memory. It experiences it all over again as a biophysical reaction. So your fight, flight, freeze, whatever your reaction to that sort of thing surfaces right back up. And it's almost as if you're experiencing two traumas at once. Mm-hmm. That has been my experience from trauma from my youth. I began to behave again like a scared young boy who was really convinced that you couldn't trust people and you had to push people away before they could hurt you. And so I began doing that again. And people only have but so much tolerance for that at the end of the day. And I began to distrust again, and largely because a lot of people couldn't handle my grief, if I'm being honest. As I began to grieve and really went into a mourning period, it really was, the truth of it was that our culture is so ill-equipped to, one, know how to grieve, but then also to handle people who are grieving. And so people began to act awkwardly around me. They began to say very trite or cliche things and platitudes, particularly people of faith. I know that a lot of your audience are Christians. And I was, frankly, I was a little disappointed with a lot of Christians who showed up in my life with cliches and platitudes rather than depth and wanting to exile with me. Mm. And so, yeah, very tough time. I observed, and I have long observed, but it became very real to me that our culture is just so ill-equipped. And so a lot of the book, from the very beginning point, is a bit of cultural critique. I try to really leave a lot of space for the reader to kind of think for themselves and almost react to the entries. It's written in an entry kind of journal style with short, you know, with anywhere from a paragraph long to 1,000 words, depending on the subject of that particular entry. And really want to leave room for the reader to react, but also offer some critique and some commentary there as well, especially the culture and just kind of where we're at as a culture, because we not only do we not really understand the importance of lament in our own lives, but we leave very little room for others to do the same. And so as a result, a lot of us are walking with a limp and we're not having conversations about it. So that's a big part. And then the book gets intensely personal too, which when I first wrote it, you know, I didn't even have a thought that other people would want to read it. It was more catharsis for me on the personal side. But there you have it. So,
well, and the entries I've been able to read are incredibly moving, I think compelling, insightful. They're raw. This is maybe a PG-13 book. But I do think, and I love that you were writing this for your own path towards healing, but also I'm really glad you're making it available to the world. I think there's a lot of us who, as you said, are walking with a limp. We don't even know it. You know, the trauma from the past, not really knowing how to grieve. You know, you've referred to, you know, we live in a culture that's all about winning. So what happens when things don't go your way? And frankly, we have a cultural churchianity that even espouses, you know, if you believe, then you will be blessed and all will go right. Maybe because a lot of church leaders listen to this, share with us, what are some of the ways the best folks responded, or the ways you wish the church would respond in seasons like you've been experiencing?
Well, candidly, I wish they had responded with wisdom. And wisdom really only comes from, you can't analyze, you can't stay in an analytical mode always and have wisdom. You have to kind of go through the grind, the emotional grind. If you think about Israel, it was only in exile that they really came close to God. When things were like going well, it was like that's when the bickering almost started. You know what I mean? Like that's when, you know, David forced himself on Bathsheba. Things were great. And he felt like, why go to war? Everything's awesome, you know? And and then you look at all the exiles and those experiences, that's where growth really occurred. And one of my, you know, one of my contentions in the book, and one of the things that I put forth, is fecal matter is fertilizer, whether we like it or not. And God will allow some shit to be spread across the lawn of your yard. He will, for your growth, for your, it is where growth occurs. There's no, you know, there's no apparent better way. We don't like it and we wouldn't sign up for it. I mean, you'd have to be sadistic to sign up for it, I understand. But when it's happening, there is something, if you can endure, if you can persevere, that just is so beautiful. And so I wish the church really focused more on some of that. I mean, the books of wisdom in the Old Testament, the writer of Ecclesiastes contends a sad face is good for the heart. Better to be a house of mourning than a house of celebration. And so what do these things mean? And sure, they're being written in an existential context, but they're dealing with existentialism. You know, like we give credit to Soren Kierkegaard as the father of existentialism. I would argue the writer of Ecclesiastes is that father. And so, I mean, I remember being a new believer, in fact, when I was 28, and I was reading Ecclesiastes, and I remember saying to my wife, Shala, like, did you know this was in the Bible? And she said, well, I've heard of the book. And I was like, but have you read it? Like, and why have I never heard it really taught on? I mean, I grew up in church. I didn't become a believer until I was 28, but I grew up in the environment of fundamentalism and religion. And no one really talked about the existentialism. It was more of the, you know, you have Jesus and everything's going to be okay. And so, as you intimated, if things aren't okay, it's almost like Job's friend's response. Well, you must have done something that things aren't okay, because if you didn't, you know, if you hadn't misstepped, if you hadn't done something, then surely you would be experiencing more joy right now, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a dark look at, you know, I mean, how do you handle Gethsemane? Mm-hmm. you know what I mean? How do you handle, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's a legitimate feeling of deep loss, you know.
This side of eternity is broken, you know, and when we suffer, we actually have the opportunity to experience more of what it must have been like to be Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. That's what Paul says in Philippians 3, you know, I want to share in your sufferings. Mm. But on the other side of the crucifixion is the resurrection. I want to spend just a minute asking you, you know, certainly the book has been cathartic, writing what, you know, your, these journal entries in many ways. For someone who is grieving, what are other parts of the process that you were surprised by or that helped you that you would recommend people consider? I mean, you mentioned something really important earlier. The trauma of childhood comes back in the midst of a new trauma. Like, what are some other things you've learned that could help someone that's going through a really hard time?
Well, I would say a couple of things. One, grief is not linear. We're a linear kind of culture. I think we're, some of that is changing, but we're still very much based in linear pathways. A plus B plus C will lead to D. Doesn't always work that way. So even Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying, the five stages of grief, which are brilliant, they're not linear. It's, I mean, you know, if you've ever grieved, it's not like you go into denial and then when you've checked it off, you go into anger and then you go, well, I've dealt with my anger and now I'm going into, you know, bartering or what, you know, or, you know, and then I've bartered my way. Now I'm sad and, you know, now I'm not sad anymore. Now I've accepted it and it's gone. That's not how grief works. The truth is, it's nonlinear. You bounce around. You can all in one day be in denial and anger and then move towards some semblance of acceptance and then go, the right or the wrong thing, depending on your vantage point, can happen. And you're right back into denial and anger. And I would say the other thing is no one is an expert on how you feel, not even yourself. If I can say that, there are emotions and things. And I think I realize that there is a limitation in our language. I begin to feel things. And I think it's why we love music. You know, you always hear that music is the language of emotion, because what we're saying is we're limited in our own language to even say what exactly we're feeling. You know, I would have these intense emotions. I was like, I don't know a word for this. And just realizing, I don't even know what it is, but allow yourself to feel it. And then I would also say, as a part of the grieving process, I would be very wary of trying to hide the emotion somewhere in a metaphoric drawer or something that you think you've locked and you don't have to deal with them. There is no place that you're going to put your emotions around loss and around grief and around just even disappointment and heartache, any type of loss. There's no place you're going to put them where they're just going to dissipate naturally. Time does not heal all wounds. That's a that's a myth, you know. And you know, over time, you might not have the initial, pain that you might initially have when you first experience loss, but it doesn't go away. And it will rear its head in, you know, ugly ways. So I would say if you put them away in a drawer and you try to lock that drawer, I hope for your sake that you go and open the drawer willingly instead of life forcing that drawer open. It is at least easier if you open it yourself.
Yeah.
Which
is really good. You know, obviously in the context of counseling, community, you know, support from someone who has that wisdom. I think you're exactly right. This is so well said. I'm really grateful for certainly our friendship, really grateful for this book. And I've just really appreciated, Rob, over the years, just how authentic you are, you know, and it's hard to be authentic when things aren't going your way, but it's also what genuine friendship and the scriptures call us to, a level of family, you know.
Yeah.
I want to just give you another, you know, chance to share, like, if you had a magic wand, and certainly, you know, people picking up this book could help, but what would the church look like if we were fully functioning with an authenticity and an awareness of the brokenness in which we live, this world?
Well, that's a heady question. I think the position that I wanted to write this book from was a passenger, not a driver or an onlooker. And so I would say, kind of in a pithy way, I would say, I'm not bringing my expertise to the subject as much as I'm bringing my experience.
Hmm.
And so I wish the church were more like that. I wish, instead of trying to position themselves on experts about God, they would focus more on the experience with God, which I think would be much more intriguing to a lot of people. I tell people right now, as you know, my friends who are believers, I say, throughout this entire process, I've been given the assurance of with, not the assurance of why. I feel like God has said in his unique ways, I'm with you, not I'm going to tell you why. You're going to understand everything. And again, we are an over analytical culture where we want to understand everything. And, you know, it's very difficult for us to brace effect if we don't know cause. And sometimes you just don't know. And so you have to live in effect, whether or not you know the cause or not. The other thing I would say towards the church is, grief is the most authentic thing that you ever experience in your life. I would say even more authentic than love. Grief doesn't care at all if you look like a fool. And the deeper you go into grief, you care less if you look like a fool. Because when you're really grieving, you don't care if you're a mess. The grief is too intense. And I remember, I've heard a story recently of a woman who lost her father. And he lived in like an assisted living home where he had a room. And then, you know, you had the common areas. And, you know, most people know how assisted living works, especially if you're our age and your parents are, you know, long to that point. Anyway, she was going into her father's room after he had passed, and she was going through his things for the first time, and it got so emotional for her, she began to sob and then to wail. She just could not. The grief was so intense. And her husband stood in the doorway and admonished her and said, "Pull yourself together. You're embarrassing me." And I think that's a perfect illustration of what it's like culturally, even in the church. But grief doesn't care. Grief is authentic in that way. It doesn't care about our religiosity or sanctimony or piousness. It just doesn't care. And it will chop us down to a point of humility that I hope is still a Christian virtue. I'll be honest with you, I'm starting to wonder sometimes the way a lot of Christians show up publicly and would rather fight than yield. But grief takes us to a place of humility. And like, as I said before, I think we have a role in it to become humble or to become humiliated. It's our choice. And I think also that you can't fully understand grace if you don't understand grief. Because grief is where empathy grows and compassion grows and an understanding of, man, they're going through something intense. I've been through something intense, and I want to help them. I don't always understand what they feel, but I know how it feels to feel really, really, you know, grief-stricken and mourning. And I think the same holds true for gratitude, even as we, you know, step into, you know, at the time we're recording this, this is the week of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know how to really give thanks if you haven't grieved. Mm-hmm. Because it's easy to begin to think that we're the masters of our own domains and we're the mm-hmm. we're the people who made it all happen, when in reality, a lot of it is a gift. And only in grief do you realize, wow, I didn't appreciate some of the things that I had until I did not have them, until I lost them. Mm. And that can be an ambition. I mean, when I think, you know, when people think about loss, I think the first obvious place is you lose a loved one, you lose someone close to you. But there are all kinds of losses. There are losses from chronic illness. There are losses of jobs, dream jobs. There's the loss of not getting into your dream school. There's the loss of a relationship that you feel like you worked hard to salvage or save, or maybe didn't do anything to deserve the loss. Those are hard, hard things to manage. And so I think in that vein for the church, if we led with experience more than expertise, I think we would help teach the culture how to live in grief. And I wish that we did lead the culture more. I wish we did have a better understanding of when people are going through difficulty, knowing how to just behave around them, knowing how to walk with them. That if God has given me the assurance of with rather than why, shouldn't the people that represent Jesus's body on earth be able to do the same thing?
That's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I so well said. I just highly recommend going to roboverholt.com. That's R-O-B-B Overholt, H-O-L-T. The book is going
to
be a gift.
Also go to grieftheBook.com.
I like it. I'll be giving away copies to some of those of you who get the newsletter. If you don't, sign up at my website, ericbryant.org. And if you don't win, pick up a copy, pick up several copies, maybe for a small group at your church. I love this idea of the assurance of with. And I think that your references, you know, to Ecclesiastes, of course, Jeremiah, the laments in the Psalms, like the Hebrew scriptures give us a great deal of mourning in this broken world.
And instruction. I mean, you had the Hebrews had sitting Shiva. You know, keening and wailing of the Celts and other cultures across the world. You've had an understanding of what it is to not only personally carry grief, but to corporately and communally carry grief. And so one of the things I even say in the book, and this is a hard thing I think for us to hear, is typically what happens if someone goes into grief, even if you've lost a loved one, again, kind of with some humor, the casserole brigade shows up, you know, for 2-3 weeks, maybe a month or two, meal trains and that sort of thing. People and benevolently and generously provide in that way. But most people in grief are in shock during that period. Mm-hmm. And just when the shock is starting to wear off, people in our culture have gone back to their busy lives. And so right when the shock is wearing off for the mourner, everyone sort of disappears. And one of the guys I interview in the book who had to see a community through a very dark time in Colorado, I love what he said. He said, grief needs a long-term partner, and most well-meaning people drop off very quickly.
Hmm.
And so that kind of, you know, again, just understanding that, walking with people, you know, it's very difficult, but it's very much, you know, the path of Jesus. Jesus, after all, was the man of sorrows. You know, we don't like we like to put that in the thing. Well, it was his sorrow so that we could have nothing but joy. And I do think that he drank from the cup of sorrow so that we might drink from the cup of joy in his resurrection. But I also believe that to follow him is to understand. If you don't understand, like I grew up with being told about the rapture, which I don't personally believe is a thing. But I think it was the Christian way of saying, I don't want to have to deal with that kind of sorrow. The world deserves to. Mm-hmm. We don't. When in reality, God doesn't spare us either. And I think, thank God he doesn't on my finer days. I think, thank God he doesn't, because that's where I can connect with the world, because we all have loss. There's very few things in the entire world that everyone shares. The only thing, two things I can think of now are COVID and loss. And there was a lot of loss with COVID. I mean, yeah, like that was a period, and we just want to jump back to normalcy. It's tough.
Well, the first time I've ever been a part of a worship night with a time for lament was at Gateway South Austin. Tasha from Build the Bridge, she was on our staff at the time, led us in that time. It was in the midst of a summer where there'd been several African-American men shot and killed by police, and then policemen were shot and killed in Dallas. And I'd never experienced that before. And I think, like you're saying, that's just too often neglected in at least the white American church. And I just want to say it out loud. I mean, certainly we miss having you guys in our home every Sunday night, watching Downton Abbey or whatever it might have been. But your impact on our church is still felt. The momentum we began to experience when you and Shala Laney were here is just, you know, we made it through COVID. We're still growing up and to the right, you know, after regrouping, but some of the principles and things you've taught us have continued, even if you guys moved to get into cooler climate. But I'm excited about the book. Thank you for taking the time to share a little bit about it. Thank you for writing it and sharing your heart with the rest of us. I think your authenticity is going to bring a lot of people healing. So thank you so much, Rob. Grateful for you.
Appreciate it, Eric, and I love you very much. Give my love to Deb.
Thanks for joining us on the Post-Christian Podcast. More resources available at ericbryant.org.